On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we discuss right-handed pitcher Tatsuya Imai, third baseman Kazuma Okamoto, Japanese stars coming to MLB. They need to sign this week. Where are they going to go? Then we open up the mailbag. You sent us some wonderful emails. We answer your questions, thoughts, comments, concerns, all that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that can't believe Timothy Chalamet made a whole movie about Marty Cordova. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we both saw the ping pong movie this week.
We sure did. A severe lack of Marty Cordova. Pretty clearly the worst player in Backyard Baseball 2001. He did have a good major league career, but when you go back and look at the superstars that were on that video game roster that means so much to us, Marty Cordova representing the Minnesota Twins is still one that lingers as one of the stranger selections.
In fact, you could then describe him as the least supreme. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we're both here.
Yeah,
Jordan,
we are. Look at us.
I took off some time for the holidays. I'm about to take off some time and go on vacation. But unlike ships passing in the night, we are docking at the same time to do one episode before the calendar turns over. And on this episode, it will be like one last, why haven't the Japanese players signed yet? And that is our opener. Tatsuya Imai and Kazuma Okamoto, their windows, their posting windows are still open, but they are closing oh so gradually. Like, imagine a window. You know, like when a window is like broken and it closes on its own without you, like somebody's not working with it. Very slow, very like a 45 day long window closing. And we're now at a point where there's like an inch or so between the window and the frame. They must sign by 5 p.m. on Friday, January 2nd. And as was the case with Murakami, we don't have a ton. Now, we have a little bit more with Imai and Okamoto than we did with Murakami, and we'll get into that here. Jordan, where do you want to begin? Do we want to kind of review who these players are?
Yeah, I think we should start with Imai, and let's just be clear. So Imai's deadline is Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern. Okamoto has until Sunday, January 4th.
He got an extension. He gets extra time.
I have to imagine that wasn't an accident, that if you're Scott Boras and you're representing both of these players, that you would want to not have these, in case they do end up going down to the deadline, having to juggle both of them was probably not the move. So staggering them was probably smart. We'll get to Scott Boras here at the end, but let's just review who these players are, why they are important, why we do think they are still going to get a good amount of money, and why they also serve an interesting contrast to Murakami. Obviously, you and our good pal Danny Wex covered the Murakami signing. I enjoyed listening to that pod and that conversation. So I'll get to talk about Murakami when I see him in spring training. But these players are, I think, even though we haven't heard as much in the same kind of respect, I think they're considered a little bit more plug and play. They're a little bit more like, these guys can help us win right now, which in theory makes them more appealing to contending teams in a way that Murakami evidently was not. So let's start with Imai. I know you've been digging in on him, and I'll talk about Okamoto. So Imai is a right-handed pitcher, Okamoto a third baseman. But tell me about Tatsuya Imai, who most notably and importantly, in the same way we talked about with Murakami, is 27 years old, I believe, or is, I think, turning 27 soon or turning 28 soon. And that makes him a very, so he turns 28 in May. So when you are a free agent at that age, as we saw with certainly Yamamoto, who, you know, became a free agent in his mid-20s, if you're able to buy, you know, prime years there, that's a rare opportunity for teams in free agency. And I think that's part of his appeal, but I know that's not the only reason why teams are interested in this guy.
I do want to harp on the difference between pitchers and hitters coming over, right? And this applies both for Japanese pitchers and for stateside Latin American pitchers that are playing in NPB or in the Korean League, that then come back, right? Because of the way that pitch tracking technology works now, you have a very strong understanding of how someone's stuff is going to translate when they come back over. Now, the ball itself is different in some meaningful ways, and that is significant. But you can look at Tatsuya Imai's pitch mix and his velocity and his release point and his spin and his shapes, and you could say, oh, well, that looks a lot like Luis Castillo, as our friend Yuri Kawasara mentioned on a YouTube video recently, right? You can say, oh, well, if you round down or you round up, like, these are the ranges. Whereas for a hitter, you don't know how they're going to react to the pitching, because the jump in pitching is so significant and so different that it's harder to project. And so I think teams just have more confidence in arms. And that is why most of the biggest contracts for players that have come over the years are for pitchers. And Imai presents a very cool case of things that are going to get teams excited. And I'm a big fan of Imai. I think he's pretty good. I think teams are going to think he's pretty good. And I think he's going to get paid like that. I think right now would you take the over or the under on a hundo on $100 million?
Over on 100.
Yeah.
Again, the range of projections with him, as you of course talked about with Murakami, and was very apparent, you know, one of the biggest projection misses that we've really ever seen in this space. But Imai, it's all over the place, and he's one where I could see it ending up closer to 200, especially if it ends up being a much longer deal because of his age,
right?
That maybe we are pushing, you know, 150, 160, 170. But I also think that there are some reasons for caution with him.
Sure.
That let me start with the yeah.
I'm going to start with the positives with him. Mm-hmm. So he has not always been really good. Now, yes. Why is that a positive? He was like a hyped prospect coming up, but when he showed up at NPB, he didn't click right away. He had a lot of trouble with command. He battled a couple injuries. But if you take a look at the way that his mechanics have progressed over the years, he's made a lot of positive changes. And that is something that teams in the big leagues care about, because it shows that this guy is open to feedback and he is open to adapting. He is open to coaching. He is tinkering is probably like has a negative connotation, but he's interested in developing as a pitcher, right? And because of the language and cultural gap, there are times where players come over, and this is true with American, Dominican, Venezuelan players, whatever, where there are players who are more resistant to coaching, to developing, to accepting that there are parts of what they do that don't work, that doesn't work, and then changing them. Imai has already shown a willingness to change. And I think that, and those changes have worked. And I think that is a significant, significant data point here. As far as the pitch mix goes, it's a good, not great fastball shape. It's not like super duper carry. It's a slightly lower slot. It's coming out on around a 95 mile an hour average, which helps it play up above the shape, because it's like it's good fuzz for a starting pitcher. To righties, it's mostly fastball slider, like overwhelmingly fastball slider. And that is an area where I have some concern. I think it was like 93%. Fastball and slider to right-handed hitters, and he's a right-handed pitcher. There are very few starters that are able to get away with that type of mix in the bigs. And the guys that have gotten away with it are like Spencer Strider at his peak, where it's two elite, elite pitches. I don't think that he has two elite, elite pitches. I think the slider is round, like definitely plus, but I'm not sure it's good enough where that's all he can throw. So having a third option against righties, whether that's a sinker or like a right-on-right change, I think that's a significant development point. Then the other thing is against lefties. Over his career in NPB, he struggled against lefties. He kind of figured that out a little bit this year, throwing more changes, throwing more splitters. Can he continue that success? Stateside is a big thing to monitor. So that's kind of him as a pitcher. That's where he's at. He's coming off his best season in Japan, which I think is helpful. And then as a character, he seems like more, Like, he seems like a pretty funny cat. He's willing to say stuff in a way that baseball players are not. Like, he seems honest, I guess.
Yeah, and we can get to some of the quotes from him in a recent interview he did in Japan. But before we get to that, like, I think that's a good summary of kind of where he's at. I think your point about his ability and willingness to adapt is important, but to me, it's also just about the trajectory in general, and this is also going to be relevant for Okamoto. And also, when we bring it back to Murakami, right, when we talked about Murakami, what did we keep referencing? Oh, look what he did in 2022. Oh, look what he did in 2022. Now, what he just did these past few years was still very good relative to the average Japanese hitter, but it wasn't at his best, whereas Okamoto and Imai both just had essentially their best seasons. We'll get to Okamoto was abbreviated because of injury, but I think that just the fact that he's gotten better and better and better, the fact that the strike throwing has improved every single season, whether that's related to mechanics, whether that's related to approach, I think for me, I'm less concerned about what he's going to do against righties because now the slider is a weird pitch. A couple people have noted this for him in particular. It has unusual movement.
It's like Savage. It's kind of like Trey Savage's slider in a way where it doesn't move. So when we say arm side and glove side, I just want to just quickly, if a pitcher is right-handed and they have their glove on, if a pitch moves glove side, it means it moves kind of towards the left. Arm side is towards the right. Most sliders move from right to left from a right-handed pitcher. There are some, because of the way that the ball comes out and the release point and et cetera, where it almost like backs up.
Right. Where,
and that's like Trey Savage's slider is like the perfect example.
Yeah, I mean, Savage is because it's so weird because of the arm slide. In this case, it benefits because it's unusual and it's hard enough and clearly he's doing it roughly on purpose. Whereas normally when you say, oh, a breaking ball backs up, that's not normally considered a good thing.
Right.
But in this case, it's just an unusual movement profile for the slider. To me, it's more about how does he get lefties out in the majors? Like that's and yes, he was throwing more splitters but that would be more of my concern is that to make sure that those pitchers are good enough because he probably can throw mostly fastball slider to righties. I mean, the best pitchers can in the big leagues and can do just fine. The other thing about it is he's not a big dude. Obviously, Yamamoto did a lot for the
short
average
kings.
Looking pitcher. Yeah, the short kings out there.
Well,
I think it's lazy
I
to just
pause
be like,
on that.
Yeah.
I want to press pause on that because the thing about Yamamoto and like Pedro Martinez is this too. There are certain short people. When you see them, you're like, oh my God, you're like outrageously athletic, even though you're short, right? This is obviously very different. I remember when we saw Simone Biles at the celebrity softball game. Wow. And I just remember the way that she... And the way that she was, like, when she walked, like, she was just walking. And I was like, that is nuts. Like, Yamamoto, when you see him warm up before a game, you're like, that is an elite athlete, no matter how tall they are.
Right.
So I think it is tougher to compare anybody to Yamamoto for any reason.
For sure. And the thing is, and it's just the timing is, of course, we're still thinking about Yamamoto, and you want to say that helps Imai. And I'm sure in some respects it will help the premise of a smaller pitcher who's able to have clearly plus stuff and is at least a plus on mound athlete. All that said, Yamamoto, because he is seemingly one of the best athletes in the sport and also what he was when he came over, which was arguably the best pitcher that Japan has ever seen, much longer track record, much more success, much larger workload, like
better stuff.
Just better, deeper arsenal, like better command. All of these things is why it's way too lazy to just be like, oh, hey, here's another 5'10 Japanese righty. He's going to be like Yamamoto. Like, no, probably not. But I will say that is something that if you remove Yamamoto from it completely, the average team is going to be like, all right, is this 5'10 righty going to be someone that's going to, you know, make 30 starts a year over this 6 or 7 year contract that we're about to give him, you know, because that's something that he's never done, right? I mean, he just set his career high in innings this year. It was last year with 173. So we know those standards are lower now for all starting pitchers. So it'd be unfair to hold Imai to too high a standard there. But when we're talking about potentially an enormous contract for a starting pitcher for $25 million a year, like these are things that teams are going to have to consider. So I think that's important. But when we get back to him as a character, and let's now talk about him as like where's he going to go?
Where he's going to play?
That's obviously what people care about. Okay, you guys have talked about him as a pitcher. He sounds pretty good.
But what about my team?
Yeah, is he going to be on my team? And So we had this, again, calling it a report is a little misleading, but when the New York Post puts it out, it becomes, feels more like news here in America. But a lot of these Japanese players are doing interviews all the time in Japan, and sometimes they get aggregated in English and translated, sometimes they don't. And because we've had so little news, really, over the last week, and because this posting window has come up, we ended up with a headline involving an interview that Imai did where he was basically like, man, like, I don't know, we don't have anything too concrete, which initially was translated poorly to say, I have no offers, and then everyone freaks out and is like, oh my God, the teams aren't offering him anything, like, this is terrible. I think we've gotten a little bit more clarity there where he's basically being like, it's the process is going slowly. It's going to be different for every player in this interview. Of course, our pal Yuri translated it here. He references, you know, how nobody knew what was going to happen with Murakami. He references what happened with Yoshida a few years ago where like no one knew anything. And then suddenly he signed with the Red Sox. So I bring all this up because obviously, coming off of Murakami, where we heard so little, we're almost getting panicked to assuming that like nothing's happening and that he's going to settle for a one-year deal. I don't get the sense that that is what is going on here. I will say, though, it is much harder to like than very few explicit connections to teams. We've kind of had to do the connecting ourselves. Yes, at the early part of the offseason, we heard the Mets are maybe interested, the Phillies are maybe interested, the Cubs are maybe interested. But unlike with Okamoto, where we've had a little bit more substantial connections with player and team, this is pretty wide open. Like, I could still kind of talk myself into believing that sure. A lot of teams are still in play here.
But that's the case with any pitcher, right? I think for a third baseman like Okamoto, you look around the league and you're like, sure. Well,
who needs a third baseman?
He's not going to play for the Padres. I guess
well,
maybe
no, he's still maybe going to play for the Padres. Whatever. There's a lot of,
bad example.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, but like there are places where you're like, oh, he's not playing.
Not going there.
Yep. You know, he's not going there.
Yep.
With a starting pitcher, it's like every team, like Imai would be a playoff starter on every team.
Ironically.
Except the Dodgers.
Except the Dodgers.
Right. Except the Dodgers.
Probably not right. The Dodgers. So we're assuming
and so
the
because
Dodgers,
of that,
we're going to very cautiously move the Dodgers to the side here. And we'll see how stupid we look
dangerous.
When I get on this microphone next week. But to your point, like you can really talk
if,
now
if
again.
They sign him, yeah. Dude, if they sign, so just, let's just be clear. If the Dodgers sign Imai, what they're saying is one of two things. It's either saying we're going to do a six-man rotation, or they're saying Roky Sasaki is a reliever. Like, there's no other option because it is Yamamoto, Snell, Glasnow, Ohtani.
I don't know what that says if they sign him, but I'm just going to let's move that to the side. Okay. To your point, though, while we are still trying to gauge how much money he's going to get, and in theory, that would limit the possibilities for some teams, you can really talk yourself into a lot of these other teams. The Orioles are certainly very interesting, right? We assume that they are still a team that is looking to land a frontline starter, even after trading for Shane Baz, right? The Mets were still wondering, like, okay, when are we moving forward? I know they've made some additions in a way that the Yankees clearly have not, right? The Yankees are another team that,
yeah,
I think at the start of the offseason, it felt like maybe they would be involved. Jack Curry, who I trust on the Yankees more than basically anybody. Pretty strongly saying after the winter meetings that he really does not believe that the Yankees are a suitor for Imai. Like I do put stock in that. So who are the other teams that you're watching here that you can talk yourself into? I think
the Giants. Such a big one.
They are the most obvious one on paper, and yet we've had reporting all offseason that they are not interested in spending real money at all, which is just like maddening. But they are the best fit on paper, I think, for sure.
Their rotation last year, like they were good at run prevention, but they're like a starter short even after signing Adrian Hauser. I mean, Logan Webb, Robbie Ray, Hauser, Landon Rupp, Kaiwei Tang, Carson Wisenhunt. Like they could use another guy.
Yes.
I think the Mets are definitely... The problem with the Mets is if they sign a starter, they need to subtract from their mix, right? They have five guys right now with McClain, Peterson, Holmes, Manaea, Senga, and then they have Tong, and they have Sproat, and they'll have Christian Scott coming back. Like, they have too many cooks already. So, like, yeah, you can move Holmes to the bullpen, but you can't just, like, like, what are you going to do with Chaminade? You're paying it $25 million. You have to do something else here. You can't.
Yeah,
and they've done, like, what the Mets have done on the position player side, where they're almost like subtract. They're taking two steps back to take a uncertain amount of steps forward. Right. TBD. They have not done that on the pitching side. Right. And so they have not really cleared a path to make those additions. The Phillies, I'm interested in. How much do they trust Andrew Painter to make the team out of camp? Wheeler, when will he be back? Taiwan Walker, do they really trust him as a starter? Those are all things to monitor. And then I don't think the Orioles are going to do it. It's enticing because they don't like giving up picks, and he wouldn't cost the pick, which is significant. And then I think the Braves should do it, but they won't. Mm-hmm. They won't because of the budget. The same thing is true for the Red Sox. I think the Red Sox could really use another guy that they trust at the front of the rotation. They won't because they're going to try and use that money on Bregman. So as far as I'm concerned, I think to me, it's like from a fit perspective, it's the Giants and then it's everybody else.
I agree. Well, I would also say the Padres, but like we're going to talk about them in a sec with Okamoto. Like we're assuming that they don't have the money to go long term on a pitcher. I think I don't know. The Cubs are another team that we thought
the Tigers
yeah,
should do this.
Sure, they seem to have some other stuff going on right now. So I don't know. It's really hard. It's really hard to see. I started to talk myself into the Diamondbacks, who still need to have to add starting pitching, I would think. And obviously they shocked us with Corbin Burnes, who was a Boris client a year ago. And again, presumably they would need to move off some money.
Dude.
And that would be a surprising fit.
Dude, the A's, dude.
The A's, you want to get him out of
the A's,
Sacramento?
Dude.
Because the other thing is because of his age, I think it's more likely that a team like the Mets, that a Stearns Elias type would be willing to pay for a starter. I think is
the
part about this.
You mean a nerd? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. The Phillies is the one that I kind of I'm feeling like they're weird because if you look at their offseason to-do list at this point, it's like JT and then probably that's it. I think you could argue they still need another starter, which why might would make sense. But I don't know. This is where we're at. I think you can talk yourself into more than you could with Murakami, right? With Murakami, it was much harder to find the spot. Here, it's just like, who's it going to be? Does this bidding actually get to something significant? Not like Yamamoto levels, but does it start to push late where it's like these three teams in the next, 48 hours, do we start to hear that like these three teams are really going for it and the number gets really high? So I don't know. It feels unlikely that we end up in a situation where he takes like a shorter term deal to then re-enter the market after he proves himself. Like, I don't think that's what's going to happen here. I don't know. I don't know. This is a funky one. And I will say the last big picture point about Imai, and then we'll do Okamoto quickly, is that like this seems to be what's holding up the starting pitching market. We have not seen, this is the part of the offseason that has not really happened yet. And that is both in free agency and in trade. There's a lot of these other trades. Sure, we've seen some starters move here and there. And a couple signings, the Merrill Kelly, of course, Dylan Cease early.
But Dylan Cease one is just completely separate because the Blue Jays just went, they rushed the market. They went
they
above
just
and beyond.
Like, this is our guy. We need Dylan the money. Cease. We want him. And we made it happen. And clearly Dylan Cease was happy with that. But obviously, Ranger and Fromber are still there. You go to that next level down with the Gallon, with Giolito, with, Bassett, with the older guys like Verlander, Scherzer, depth guys like Littell. And then on the trade market, which is, I think, still something that we're watching very closely, whether it's a Mackenzie Gore, whether it's an Edward Cabrera, like you got to have some more movement before stuff happens. And this is a deadline that will, I think, give us some of that movement, especially for Fromber and for Ranger Suarez as free agent options.
Yeah.
Ranger, especially as a Boris guy, just have to imagine that we start to hear more on those guys because we've essentially heard nothing on those two. So I'm very eager to find out what happens with those guys. All right, let's do Okamoto. Quickly, this is a third baseman who turns 30 in June, Kazuma Okamoto. Like Imai, also coming off his best season, but a much longer track record of excellence. He has been the guy for the Yomiuri Giants, which is the most popular team in Japan. He has been the dude for this team for a long time. This year was abbreviated. He had a collision at first base where he injured his elbow. He mostly played some third, a little bit of corner outfield, but also some first base. So he only, you know, got like 300 plate appearances this year, but all of his numbers were basically career bests. This guy, yeah. All the concerns that you really have about Murakami from a contact standpoint, from an approach standpoint, he just posted a career low strikeout percentage. He pulls the ball in the air a lot. He is, you know, draws walks. He doesn't chase. He doesn't have quite the like, oh my God, raw power that Murakami does, but clearly the power production has been there in Japan. And also importantly, as of course you really harped on very fairly when you talked to Danny Wex about Murakami, is that I think that people are willing to give, you know, Okamoto a chance to play third. And I think as we introduce some of the teams that are clearly seem to be in the running to sign him, I think that that's apparent when the three teams that we've heard the most about are the Pirates, the Angels, and the Padres. Now, the Padres, as you kind of mentioned earlier, obviously he's not going to play third over Machado. That's one where they're still trying to get creative in just adding offense. And if they can come up with some sort of creative contract, or if they trade someone that gives him some more money, I can see why Okamoto would be a good addition for them to be first base, DH, maybe some corner outfield. But the Angels and Pirates are two of the teams with the biggest third base holes in the league. And clearly teams that, depending on how you talk about them, are trying to win now, right? Pittsburgh, we've seen, as you talked about last week, the moves that they've started to make with O'Hearn, with Brandon Lau. Like they're finally spending some money. And third base is still very unsettled since they traded away Ke'Bryan Hayes. They kind of have a spot there that is not super obviously filled. And so they're going after Okamoto. They're going after, you know, Gino Suarez, which makes a lot of sense. That'd be a kind of a good way to complete their offseason. How much is it going to cost? We're going to see. That's also the question for the Angels, who so far have just spent very little money on just a few relievers. And everyone just says, well, if Artie Moreno wakes up one day and decides he wants Okamoto on his team, then maybe he will submit the highest bid and have Okamoto on his team because they don't really have a third baseman. And, you know, they could do that. But I don't know. It would be really cool to see the Pirates, you know, stick the landing on this offseason here and get Okamoto. I don't love the fit offensively in Pittsburgh. This is not exactly a place where like right-handed hitters, power hitters are going to go thrive. It is one of the largest left-handed, just like left fields that we have in baseball. And I do a little bit worry about the power production from Okamoto there. But in general, I still think it would be awesome if they could get that done, especially because it would probably be a contract that would immediately break the record that Ryan O'Hearn just set, right? For the largest ever for a Pirates position player. I don't really know what to expect for a length of deal for Okamoto. He is a little bit young for a free agent, but there may still be some wariness to go too long and think that he doesn't have that much of a peak left. So,
yeah.
And then maybe there's another team. Maybe there's another team that pops up here. But I think at this point, based on the reporting, and the A's are another interesting one. You want to keep throwing them out there. Third base is really their only unsettled position. So that is an interesting one. But they don't need offense. So that would be a weird use of resources, I would say.
And lastly, let's cross off the Dodgers.
We can cross off the Dodgers.
Hopefully.
I think we can cross off the Dodgers. Although, as many people pointed out about Murakami, it's like, if Murakami, if he goes and hits 90 homers over the next 2 years, and Freddie Freeman and Max Muncy are gone. More on that with an email in a second. All right. That is Okamoto. That is Tatsuya Imai. We will find out. We're not going to have a show later this week, but you will hear from me next week telling you about where these guys signed. The last thing on these two before we take a break and then go to the mailbag is, again, that this is pretty enormous Scobo potential. With Scott Boras representing both of these guys, with their markets still unclear, let's see where this ends up, right? maybe, you know, if my pops out and gets 200 million, you know, we'll give Mr. Boris a nice round of applause. If Okamoto gets a 1-year deal from the Pirates, you know, that's probably not such a big win for Mr. Scoba, but we will not give him a grade just yet. However, we do have to give a grade quickly to a Scott Boras signing that did happen. You might have missed it, folks, but Paul Blackburn.
You might have missed it.
But Paul Blackburn, to our knowledge, is represented by Scott Boras, and he is back on the Yankees.
Draw.
I'm almost sitting, again, it's $2 million to stay with the Yankees. I almost want to give this a win for Scott Boras amidst presumably the Cody Bellinger negotiations.
That's a win. Paul Blackburn, I know he was like interesting down the stretch for the Yankees or whatever. Some Yankees Twitter accounts were like, he could be the next Luke Weaver.
Yeah.
Like, he was buns, dude. He had a 6-2-3.
To get the Yankees to be like, hey,
yeah,
we got to get Paul Blackburn done here. We got to make sure that this happens.
Let's just do Blackburn.
Okay.
Let's do Blackburn first. That's okay. A W.
Yeah, that's a W. We're going to give him Paul Blackburn a dub. And you know what? Because of that, we'll be a little bit tougher of a grader for Imai and Okamoto. I promise to be a little bit more rigorous when we give him a Scobo grade next week. All right, so a dub for Scott Boras brings him to the season to 10 wins, 4 draws, and 9 losses this winter. We're going to take a break. When we return, your emails. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, go Sabres. Let's open the mailbag. As you all know, the baseball offseason is not exactly headline stuff at the moment. But you know what's headline stuff? Your emails. So we asked for them, and you delivered. And we will begin with an email from Derek. Derek says, "Dear Jake and Jordan, longtime listener, first-time caller, emailer. I've been a diehard New York Mets fan since David Wright, Jose Reyes, and Carlos Beltran stole my 8-year-old heart and dropped the Yankees in the garbage like the Toy Story 'I Don't Want to Play With You Anymore' meme. But after this year's winter meetings, it is clear to me and many others that Steve Cohen has signed off on the David Stearns vision and has let Stearns run the show. I have 2 questions. 1. Do you think that David Stearns even wanted to sign Juan Soto in the first place? 2. Do you think that there is a chance that Juan Soto is the next A-Rod? This is so freaking spicy, dude. In the sense that A-Rod signed the largest contract with the Rangers only to be traded to the Yankees. It's not apples to apples. The Mets don't need to cut payroll. Soto and this awful fan fiction goes to the Dodgers in 3 years. Huge fan. Love the work you guys do. Thanks, Derek." Let's begin with number 1. Do you think that David Stearns even wanted to sign Juan Soto in the first place? Yes.
I do think, I have thought about this a lot, where it's just like, at the start of last offseason, was there like what was the meeting? How many people were involved in the like, we're going to try to get Juan Soto meeting? Was that, how long did they have to talk about it? Did David Stearns have to actually like crunch the numbers and be like, do I want Juan Soto on my team or not?
Crunching the numbers is a great point, right? Because for some players, it is like a binary, do we want them, yes or no? Like, there are some teams that had a meeting this winter on like Gino Suarez, and people presented a deck on Gino Suarez, and the people at the end determined, nah, we're good. Or yeah.
Right.
Like, did David Stearns have to think like, do I want this?
Because you can't, I mean, obviously, people have computers and a lot of people work in these front offices. You could run all these models on any player. But to your point, you first have to decide, like, all right, are we interested? Because if you're a team interested in starting pitching, you first want to identify who your targets are. And then you want to figure out how much they're worth and how much they're worth to you. But in Soto's case, yeah, like for so many reasons, it's like, how much time do they really spend on that? Or did David Stearns know for a fact, like, this ain't my thing. Yes, I would like Juan Soto. Yes, I can say I believe in Juan Soto, the baseball player. That had to have happened first, right? Like, there had to have been a conversation between
Cohen, Damon, and Stearns. He's good, right?
Yeah, he's there, good, no, right? No, seriously, I do believe there had to be a conversation where at some point where Steve Cohen was like, listen, is this a player from just strictly baseball, what he has done, how he profiles, how he fits in our ballpark?
No, David, forget the number. David, forget the number. Forget the number, David.
There has to be some version of like, is this a good baseball player that we want on our team for a long time? That conversation had to have happened. It might have been 5 seconds long, but I think that had to have happened at some point.
Sure. Now, after did that, David Stearns want Juan Soto? Yes. Every single general manager, Pobo in baseball, wants Juan Soto. Every single person would take Juan Soto for $5 million. Every team would take him for $10 million, right? Whatever. I think with Stearns, and this is sort of happening with Mike Elias in Baltimore, it happened with Andrew Friedman when he went from Tampa to LA. When you're, this is an outrageous thing to say, when you're raised in, quotes, poverty, and you learn how to exist.
Raised.
Yeah, when you're molded in the Rays and the Brewers world and in pre-David Rubenstein Orioles world, and you learn how to succeed and survive in that environment, you have to then readjust how to act when you get money. And I think Stearns is going through those growing pains. Now, I think that David Stearns wanted to sign Juan Soto for $750, $65 million? No, I don't. But I also think that he both understood that value didn't make sense, but also that the money, and this is true for every team, the money only matters in terms of what it allows or prevents you from doing. And giving Juan Soto $765 million is not going to prevent the Mets from doing something else. Whereas it would prevent the Brewers from like existing.
Right. Yes.
That's an important dynamic to understand.
Yeah. No.
Now, I don't think David Stearns, I don't think David Stearns walked into the meeting when he got hot, like the interview with Steve Cohen was like, here's my plan. Sign Juan Soto.
Step one,
you know.
Step Sign one. Step two.
Let's go to
miss the postseason.
Miss the postseason. Okay. Trust me. Okay, it's gonna get good. Step three. Sign Jorge Polanco.
Soto as A-Rod. I mean, there's a lot.
Context
going on here. Yeah.
We have done an entire podcast on A-Rod, where we had A-Rod as a guest. And I would say that Jake and Jordan are just low on A-Rod as a character.
It depends. He's
interesting.
Up and down.
He's compelling.
Up and down on Rod.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm low on Rod. I just find him to be a bit of a robot. I think that Juan Soto is infinitely more likable than A-Rod as a character. I think that will help him here. Yeah. Again, we weren't alive in prognosticating through the A-Rod era, and maybe media has changed, but I just find myself more endeared with Soto and believe that other people are too, whereas A-Rod never felt like a hero.
Yeah, I don't know if Derek is literally intending to provide any commentary on Soto as a character compared to just like, A-Rod signed the largest contract ever, and then they immediately tried to get rid of it, you know, a couple years later because it didn't make any sense. And as he points out in his email, like, that seems unlikely to happen with the Mets.
The biggest difference is that Soto can opt out.
Sure. Yes. But I will also say that I do think that there is something to, and we're already seeing it. We already saw it this year, whether it was fair or not. Like, that contract is going to just be what is. It's going to hang over Juan Soto's head forever, no matter what. Like, whether the Mets are great, whether the Mets are, like, it's always going to be now part of his story.
It's its own
and
character.
He's not going to be able to escape that. Now, how he chooses to handle that, how we as media responsibly cover that, let alone how fans react to it, who's to say, we're going to find out. But I do think that in the way that I imagine it defined A-Rod for a while, before a lot of other things defined A-Rod. But my understanding is for at least those first few years of the contract, both certainly in Texas and then, you know, beyond, it was like, well, yeah, this is the guy that signed the biggest contract ever. Like, that's And it was deserved, right? In the same way that Soto has had this historic start to his career. Like, that was A-Rod. Same thing, man. Like, yeah, those numbers are pretty crazy. So I think in that sense, there's some comparisons. As for do I think he's not going to be on the Mets for a long time? I think he's going to be on the Mets for a long time. I don't think that's
how. I also think Soto's like smarter and savvier than A-Rod is. All right, our next email is from Joshua, from JR. JR says, hello, gentlemen. As a key member of my high school's bench, the 1 year I played baseball, the most fun I ever had in a practice was when the coaches had us run the bases like madmen, taking giant leads, dancing back and forth, getting into pickles on purpose against the starters so they could get reps in weird situations. What's the most fun you guys had in a practice as players or coaches? Sincerely, JR. Jordan?
I mean, this is a question for you. I mean, I haven't participated in a real baseball practice in...
Home run baseball camp counts.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously, right. We coached it at the same baseball summer camp. But that was, I mean, it's kind of funny in reference to this. What you're referencing here, JR, is essentially what camp was all day long, all the time with what we did. So it was, like, that was kind of the standard. Like,
yeah.
And when we worked at that camp, like, I wasn't coaching a team that was like going to compete against someone else. It was just like, let's, you know, make sure these kids have a good day over the summer.
Yeah.
And let's have fun playing baseball. So as far as, you know, participating in a real practice as a coach or a player, that's not something I've done in a very long time. So I'd be curious.
I mean, yeah, I have like a million. You. I got a million. Running the bases
about it
when you're
coaching. From coaching than yeah, playing, honestly.
Running the bases when you're a PO and you're a pitcher only in college is awesome. Especially when you're a bad one. When you're like a pitcher that if you get hurt, no one cares.
Which was you for 3 years.
Which was me, because like you're expected to get out. Like you're running the bases to push the issue in practice to give everyone else reps. And when you like evade a pickle, it's awesome.
And you don't have to get embarrassed, like, by hitting, right? It's just throw the helmet on.
No, that's a swing. Coach hits the ball and then a fun goes in and you just run around. This comes to mind. My freshman year, there was a kid on the team named Brian. And Brian was their DH, and Brian had really skinny and weak legs. Mm. Now, he could hit. He could really swing it. But boy, he had lower body issues, as they say in hockey. And so one fall practice, Brian like wasn't running, but he was hitting. And so what we did was we had like a net behind the catcher, and I would stand behind the net, and I would run the bases for him. So like he would hit, and the second he made contact, I would start to run, right? He gets the bat head out and crushes one to the pull side in the air. Like, I think it's gone. As I'm going down the line, I do the Sammy Sosa hop. Like, I pimp his home run and it hits off the fence.
Ooh.
I made it to second standing up. Like, I was fine.
That's...
I got in trouble because I pimped someone else's home run.
And this is the
thing.
So
yeah, that comes
when
to
you
mind.
Think with the story of Jake Mintz overcoming being bad for 3 years to be a good reliever as a senior, he was also overcoming his own, we'll just say, headery.
Yeah. Tomfoolery.
That did not, you got to stick around on the team, which is awesome. I love that.
As far as coaching goes, there is no, and this is so self-serving, and this is like half a real answer, but there is no better feeling than reminding the kids you coach that you're better than them.
Oh, man.
So what I mean by this specifically
is... This I've done at camp too. Like, it's like every once in a while, you're like, all right, this coach pitch is about to get a little more difficult.
Whether it's like letting it eat in coach pitch... Right. You're like throwing BP and then you just zip one in there at like 75 and like, oh my God, Coach Jake. Right. Or like my favorite version of this is you're doing like infield, outfield, like you're hitting fungos and then you just crank one.
You just hit one like over the fence.
You just hit one like 300 with your fungo over the fence.
And then you pretend like, oh, sorry. My bad.
Oh, sorry.
I slipped and hit a homer. My bad.
Where I coached in Harlem on 120th Street, like 122nd Street, Marcus Garvey Park, Shea Field. it was probably like 140 to right.
Right. Yeah.
You saw that field. Oh, it was like 140 to right.
Yeah.
The tall fence. And if you hit it like 230, it went into the street.
Oh, yeah.
And so like every once in a while, bang, you know, like, hey, kids, but boom. Like, I mean, like, the dorky, heartfelt answer is whenever a kid figures something out and you help them, there is like no better feeling in the world. I mean, that's like the most, that really is the most fun. Like you have a kid who's stepping in the bucket, like the worst kid on your team. When you make a physical adjustment with them and then they crank a ball.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my
that
God.
That is true. Right. That's
and then they smile when they're running to first. Like that is the best. That is the best thing in the world.
Yeah. Or like even lower level, especially when you're working with like 6 year olds, is like when you're throwing BP to kids that young that aren't even really, most of them like actually baseball players, they're just swinging. Like it's on you to hit the bat.
Right.
You, and so
you gotta find a barrel.
When you get in the rhythm of like, I am making sure this kid is hitting the ball, and you know it's
the
you,
opposite of pitching.
Yeah, it's the opposite of pitching. You know, it's like, oh, I'm making this kid. This kid thinks he's like, you know, Ty Cobb right now, but no. Like I'm making this happen. But it's fine. He doesn't need to know that. He thinks he's, you know,
no, the kids don't need to know. They don't need to know.
I'm him. Anyway, great question.
Dude, like that's the best. There was this kid I coached in Harlem named Elika, and she like had like a tough first year, had some tough swings. And then there was this day where she just cranked the ball off the wall. And like it just sticks with you forever, man. That's it.
You almost want to be like, hey, no more. Finish your baseball career on that swing.
That's it. That's it.
I've definitely felt that.
Shouts out, Elika. One of my favorite kids.
Our next email comes from Bill. Bill says, guys, love the pod. I love the pod too. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate that.
I like it.
As a Dodgers fan, I've loved the last decade watching my team win 90 games and compete for titles every year. Sounds pretty good. How much longer? Thanks for clarifying that as a Dodgers fan you have
Bill's like, man, it's been a tough run.
How much longer do you expect the Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman, Max Muncy era to last? These guys are all mid to late 30s and Mookie and Freddie are Hall of Fame bound, but how long will they justify being run out there as everyday players for a title contending team? 2 to 3 years. Otani covers up for a lot of issues.
So does Yamamoto,
folks. But the Angels proved he can't win everything on his own. What do you expect to see? When do you expect to see the generational shift for the Dodgers and who fills their shoes? I don't have an answer to this question, but I love it. And it is something I have been thinking about a lot.
It's like the biggest question in the sport.
I was thinking about it. I think it is an underrated thing when we talk about the Dodgers. And I made this point last year, even when I was like, guys, relax. It's not like they're going to win the World Series again. Oops, they did. But I do think that we've already seen when you saw how Mookie's bat is trending, as amazing it is that he's playing shortstop, right? Is Freddie Freeman, as amazing as he is, going to keep being able to play 150 games a year? Like, I don't know. And are the Dodgers going to... I think what's most interesting about this, maybe of all, is how long will the Dodgers themselves let it go on? Now, Mookie's a different conversation because he has this giant contract. But for Freddie and Muncy, it is going to be really interesting how long the Dodgers decide. Muncy's gone after the year. Yeah, after this year.
After this year, he's gone.
But I do think that for Freddie, it will be a very interesting case of like, do the Dodgers think that he is still their best option? Do they basically play it out like the Warriors and just go down with the ship? Like, we're just going to play with Steph and Draymond and as long as we can, even if we're no longer good, people are still going to enjoy coming to the ballpark.
Like the Ryan Howard Phillies teams did this, right? Sure. Where it was like, they let it go too long. And then when you let it go too long, now, the pivot is harder to make.
The difference certainly as it relates to the Phillies is that the Dodgers do have this great farm system of players and development and all these other ways to backfill and get other great players, right? In addition to free agency, Roki, Yamamoto, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But the question here is still, how long is it the Mookie Freddie show is a very interesting conversation. Ohtani is still bigger than all of them and will remain that for at least the next half decade, however long he's able to do this. Yamamoto extends this window from just a pure competitive standpoint. But I am really interested in, I do think about this a lot. We're not there yet, but I do think it is an interesting and worthwhile question.
Dodgers position player group this year was the oldest in baseball.
Yep.
They will be again. One of two teams, and it will be again. They're one of only two teams where I believe the average age of the position players was on the other side of 30, mm-hmm. them and the Phillies. The starting lineup that won game 7 of the World Series, every single player over 30. Ohtani, Smith, Freeman, Betts, Muncy, Teo, Edmund,
Rojas,
Kike, right. Rojas, right? Yep. All over 30. Mm-hmm. And so that's it. That's kind of wild.
How this manifests, we don't know. Does it mean that they lose more games in the regular season and don't win the division? Does it mean that they peter out in the postseason? We don't know what it looks like for them to actually get old. There were times we were already asking this past season. Again, when your top level talent is this good, you can overcome a lot.
Sure.
Now, but it's a worthwhile question.
I would like to, the balance between playing the vets and acquiring the Michael Confortos of the world to fill holes versus being comfortable with the young guys taking lumps at the big league level will in some ways define the next half decade of Dodger baseball.
100%.
That includes like Andy Pages, right? Who's like this very volatile player.
It includes guys on the team now. Rushing, Freeland. Like how much are these guys playing on this team?
Ha-Sung Kim.
Yeah, Ha-Sung Kim. Some of the other, their 500 outfield prospects that they have coming, right? What, now we could see some of them get traded and become Michael Busch.
Let me hop
right?
in here.
Yeah.
Exactly. The top Dodgers prospect is this guy named Josue de Paula. Okay. Awesome player. Hits the ball really freaking hard. Doesn't hit it in the air a whole lot. Or as much as he should, right? He's 20 years old. He'll probably debut at some point in 2026. Late 26, probably more likely 27.
27.
Yeah. I just got my years mixed up. Yeah. When he shows up, chances are he's not going to just hit the ground running, right? He's the type of player where it's like he's tall. There's a lot of limbs going on. He's getting to take his lumps. How willing are the Dodgers going to be to let him fail at the big league level? Failing at the big league level is how you end up succeeding at the big league level. Mike Trout ass in 2011. Pretty good in 2012. Aaron Judge.
Mike Trout, not ass in 2012.
Aaron Judge, bad in 2016.
Fact.
Right? Yep. Like, that happens. And so are the Dodgers going to be okay with that? I don't know. Last point on this. Mookie Betts, the hitter, is one of the biggest storylines of the 2026 season. Yes. It is an enormous, enormous deal. Yep. Because for all that Mookie Betts is and all that Mookie Betts has accomplished and all that Mookie Betts represents, he is one of the highest, like, Q ratings in the sport, except for, you know, talking to Aiden Ross, but whatever. Don't want to talk about that right now. He is under contract at $30 million a year for 8 more years.
Yeah. Seven more seasons.
7 more years. Yep. If he's hitting like the way he was just hitting for that entire contract, it's going to turn into one of the worst contracts in baseball.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if he's playing an above average shortstop, that certainly helps. How much longer can a 33-year-old play an above-average shortstop? Even Mookie Betts, who's awesome, whatever, worth asking. If Mookie Betts is a 90 OPS plus guy or a 120 OPS plus guy, huge difference. This year is a big year for Mookie Betts, which is a ridiculous thing to say about a guy coming off of 2 World Series titles.
Yeah, and when you have all these other great players, like, it's not, as we just saw, they don't necessarily need it, but if we're talking about this being the era defined by these players, then it is relevant. You say 120, the dude was at 160 2 years ago. Like, he was, you know, this, here's a way to think about it, right? Like, this past year was the one of only the second time essentially in his career that he did not get MVP votes. And the only other time was when he missed
significant time.
He co-hosted the MLB awards show because in part everyone knew he wasn't going to win any of the awards.
I do think that is Mookie Betts getting MVP votes anymore? He's probably not going to with the 732 OPS. So anyway, Dodgers infinite things to think about all the time. All right. Who is our next email? Let's do Caitlin.
Caitlin. Hey, Caitlin. Hi, besties. One of the reasons baseball is my favorite sport to watch is that it's a sport in which a bunch of dudes are allowed to wear jewelry, intricate hairstyles, and the like, and none of it is an indictment of their manliness. I will say this, Caitlin, just to hop in the middle of your email. It's not an indictment of their manliness anymore as much as it used to be. And I think for all of the things in our world that suck and bum us out, I do think that this is a genuine area to take a deep breath and appreciate that society in this very small little corner and pocket has gotten better. And I know it doesn't actually matter and the world is still burning and there are tons of problems with the culture of baseball. But I think you are spot on that baseball as a means to express oneself, like stylistically, this has not always been the case. And I think the game owes a lot to people like Ricky Henderson and Griffey, who have pushed the game, Reggie Jackson, who have pushed the game in that direction. And so thank you. Great email. I just want to say, it is not an indictment of their manliness anymore as much. Kike Hernandez can walk into a game wearing that, and everyone's like, that's just Kike. I would love to hear each of you discuss your favorite baseball accessories, chains, earrings, necklaces with interesting pendants, good custom cleats, neon sleeves on a certain power hitter. Happy New Year to you both. Love, Caitlin. Jordan, I'm going to have you go first here because I'm going to look
As Caitlin references neon sleeves on a certain power hitter, I think that... our hero Yoenis Céspedes was rocking during his playing days. In terms of the sleeves, the interesting colored sleeves, in terms of, I think, jewelry and like necklaces and chains, that the most basic way and to describe it is just like, how are you playing with this? You just look at some of the chains that Acuña is definitely the one now where I think this all the time, where you just see like what, not to mention how expensive these things are, but just the practical nature of like playing with a chain that size, that fancy, that expensive, and like head first diving just feels practically kind of dangerous, you know? But I do think that chains are something that just because there's such a variety and opportunity for players to kind of show off their personalities, and what they're coming up with for chains is also amazing. Cause like sometimes it's just like their initials, but in a font that you've never seen before. Sometimes it's like, here's just a character from my favorite anime. Here's, you know, something really, really simple as like back to the Mookie Betts, not a chain, but like the bat and ball, you know, necklace that he's been wearing for most of his career that just looks like something that you would, you know, pick up in the aisle of a grocery store. Like that, the range of chains and necklaces, that never gets old for me. And I also think that the thing that we've seen, especially at like the youth baseball level, just the what like Evo Shields have become in terms of wear and the style of whether it's elbow guards, shin guards, knee guards, like all these things. Like that is something that has clearly become a huge
swag
part.
For swag yeah, state.
It is. Yeah. And if you like go to the Little League World Series, it's really where you see not even just the kids playing in it, but the kids that are running around the complex and just like the Oakleys that they're wearing, you know, the sunglasses that they have, that kids are wearing eye black when they're not even playing. Like that's the kind of stuff that you just see way more common, which I, even if it's not something that I think I would do if I was playing baseball at that age, I like that it's a pretty wide range of it now.
I remember getting made fun of at a showcase. So I can't remember what company it was. It might've been Franklin or Wilson. They used to make these wristbands that you would, they were like, you know, just regular wristbands, but they came with the number 88 on it. Mm-hmm. And you would take a Sharpie and you would write the lines into the parts of the eight to make it your own number. Right. Because it's like an eight on a clock, like a digital clock, like you sure. can do it out. And I remember just getting bullied for that. And I don't know if that would happen anymore. The last thing I'll say on this, one of the Little League kids I've coached the longest, his mom is a woman named Julie Wilson, who is the beauty editor at Cosmo, which is like, you know, a big deal. And so I saw them when I was in New York a couple months ago, and we're sitting down, and she's like, did you see the necklace that Miguel Rojas was wearing when he hit the home run? And I'm like, I did not. I don't know. She was, you know, because she's the beauty editor at Cosmo, she's like, oh, well, it's a Van Cleef & Arpels vintage Alhambra necklace with, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, no, no, that's a $10,000 necklace that only women wear. And I was like, what?
Not anymore.
And she's like, I was like, not anymore. She's like, yeah, Google it. So if you Google vintage Alhambra necklace image and you just look at all the models wearing it, it's like not a lot of people looking like Miguel Rojas. And so that's cool. That's sweet. That means that like people in the sport are pushing the envelope and pushing the issue and making it more interesting. And like that necklace is just, it's not like bulky, right? But you look at it and it looks unique. So I would say, you asked this question, Kaylin, my favorite piece is the Miguel Rojas vintage Alhambra $10,000 necklace with agate jewels.
Yes.
Shout out to Julie Wilson.
Thank you to Kaylin for that email. We appreciate it. Jake, I know there's one more email you wanted to reference before we take a break and wrap it up. We got a very lengthy email from Haley, who is I believe a fairly long time listener. I think we've read Haley's emails on the show, but she really put in one heck of a performance here, in the inbox. This is a few weeks ago. I don't know if we're going to read the whole thing, but we needed to tip our cap.
Get a guarantee we're not going to read the whole thing. I just put it in a Google Doc. It is 1,033 words.
Yeah. But again, there's a reason we're referencing this, because it is worth our attention.
So for those of you who have not seen the new Knives Out movie, no spoilers. I will not spoil anything, I promise. But this email from Haley is basically about how there are multiple scenes that include a Cubs broadcast in the movie. And it is an actual plot point in Unraveling the Mystery, is the recording of, like, a taped recording of the game. And the two things that Haley points out that are really remarkable is, one, is that they did not get the permission in the movie, it seems, to use the marquee broadcast. And so they don't have the Boog Shambi commentary. Instead, the baseball commentary is dubbed over by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, of all people. So when you don't totally hear it when you're listening to it, but when you watch it back and you hear Joseph Gordon-Levitt be like, well, that's a swing and a miss. He's like doing a broadcaster voice. And then in the credits, he's listed Joseph Gordon-Levitt, hey, broadcaster.
He's in our favorite baseball movie, so I'm fine with it.
That is exactly what I was going to say. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the main character in Angels in the Outfield as a child. And so it was nice to see him doing baseball again. But the coolest part about this email and what Haley unravels here is that the specific moments in the game footage used match up with the time and date that the murder takes place. And so Rian Johnson, who directed this movie, clearly took the time to be like, oh, there's a murder. Spoilers, there's a murder in the Knives Out movie. Whoa. The murder happened on a Friday afternoon. Who's the only team that plays on a Friday afternoon? The Cubs. They use a Friday afternoon game footage from around the same time that, like, hell yeah. Because usually when baseball footage is used in a show, none of it matches up. I remember I wrote a whole thing about the Orioles game in The Wire and mm-hmm. how it's like completely copy and pasted in no real order. And it's like the seventh inning happens, then the second. And then what? This is the opposite of that. So Haley, thank you for pointing this out. We really appreciate it. We apologize that we didn't read your entire TED Talk.
Yeah. I will say, I haven't seen this yet, It sounds like a great, I'm glad the Cubs get some love here. I don't know.
Put this on Reddit, Haley.
I don't know if this is going to top the Cubs reference in the Bear, which still, I think, my favorite.
Oh, what was it?
Alfonso Rivas.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Alfonso Rivas. All right. That's it. You can email us baseballbarbiecast@gmail.com. Oh, wait. We have one more email here from Sean DePaz, producer of the What Chaos podcast. He says, go Sabres.
What's that say?
Sean, go Sabres is right.
Go Sabres.
Go Sabres. W9, go baby. Sabres. All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll go around the league quickly before we say goodbye.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbiecast. Not a lot of big signings, but there's always transactions transacting. Let's do it fast, turbo mode. The Cincinnati Reds signed J.J. Bleday.
And acquired Dane Myers. This outfield's coming together, folks. No, they didn't get Kyle Schwarber, but who cares? What a platoon they are forming in the outfield in Cincinnati. Dane Myers, a defensive maestro, J.J. Bleday, bounce back candidate. I don't know, man. The Reds are just, they are so strange. And I know Reds fans are kind of going through it right now as the Pirates fans are like having a grand old time, like actually adding good players. And the Reds, who actually did just make the postseason, are like, what is this? What is the plan? How much money do we have? It's weird times in the NL Central, as always.
The Mariners signed Rob Refsnyder. Rob Refsnyder, one of the more interesting players in baseball. He is 35 now. With this one trick, you can continue to play Major League Baseball. And that trick is crushing left-handed pitching.
Awesome story in The Athletic about Rob Refsnyder's evolution as a hitter. I believe it was Chad Jennings that did it. Just talking about how he realized, like, I have to change something or I am not going to be a Major League Baseball for very long. And he did. And now he is one of the just best lefty mashers in the entire league. And I think he will help.
Saying that he's good against lefties kind of undersells.
It does. Yeah. He's literally like the best. It's like him and Aaron Judge for the past 4 years.
It's not even that close.
Yeah.
Really. So like he's unbelievable. I have in front of me, this is like, if you do OPS against lefties, mm-hmm. you're right. It's like him, Ketel Marte,
yeah.
Jose Ramirez, Aaron Judge.
Yeah. Good player. Good job, Mariners. Good signing. The Cubs signed Hunter Harvey. Was that mentioned in the new Knives Out movie? No. The Cubs are slowly rebuilding their bullpen. They've signed Phil Maton, Hobie Milner, Jacob Webb. All of them were on the Rangers. That's kind of weird. They brought back Caleb Thielbar. They are just kind of reshuffling the random arms in their bullpen with a little bit more upside. I actually like most of these signings, but I don't think this is, speaking of weird times in the NL Central, don't think any of these moves are making Cubs fans super excited and feeling awesome after going to the postseason finally this past year. The Orioles bring back Zach Eflin. Oh, did you remember that Zach Eflin was on the Orioles in 2025? Now you do, because
yes.
He has been re-signed. The way I described this move when we met the other day is if this was their first move of the offseason, everyone would have been laughing at the Orioles. But because they've already done a bunch of other stuff, it's kind of like, hey, I kind of like that. Like
not
Zach
bad.
Eflin was really good in 2023 and 2024. He had a back injury that clearly just made his 2025 miserable. And I think that as like this is like Zach Eflin for 1 year and what is it, $10 million guaranteed? It's like a weird structure with the mutual option in 2027, whatever. This, I feel way better about this than the Charlie Morton signing a year ago. You know, like this is, I think this is a great
Zach move. Eflin started game two of a playoff series a year ago. Like Corbin Burns started game one against the Royals in 24. Eflin started game two and he's pretty good. So like
if the Orioles get another like real starter, like we're about to get crazy with the Orioles. Like I'm going to be bumping Orioles magic basically every day until opening day. But still one more starter.
Speaking, I don't care about the Orioles anymore.
Yeah.
Because the Sabres.
Yeah.
Speaking true. Well, just quickly, I think that the Zach Eflin signing kills a dream. This is an email that we have gotten multiple times. Please excuse me. I forget who sent us this email. I believe it is Zachary, that Justin Verlander has played for four of the five teams that wear orange.
Oh, man.
Tigers, Astros, point. Mets, Giants, and the Orioles were the last team on the list. And I think this Eflin signing probably takes them out of the Verlander sweepstakes.
Probably. I don't know. I wouldn't totally. Again, they did. Remember, last year they did Morton and Sugano. So
whoa.
I think I don't know. Let's not just. And hey, maybe they trade for Verlander, you know, too. There's wherever he signs.
He's going to play 10 more years.
And then
he's
finally,
a vampire. He was born in 1901.
The most important move. Again, if you listen to the pod last week, how did Jake introduce it? Nabil Chrismat, one of our favorite pitchers, whose name is Nabil Chrismat, was born on Christmas, and now he has signed a contract seemingly in proximity to Christmas, as Nabil Chrismat, the Colombian right-hander, has agreed to a minor league deal with the Texas Rangers.
Is he WBC? Awesome. Is he going to play? He better.
I assume he will be on the Colombian team.
Starting game
that's
one.
That's a team always looking
game
for.
Game two behind Quintana.
Looking for innings? He got his deal before Quintana. So how about that? So shouts out to Nabil Chrismat, who got a new contract in or around,
awesome
on
guy.
Or around Christmas. Seems like an awesome guy, and I hope he pitches forever as he just turned 31, which I'm going to do in a couple of months here. As we head towards 2026, Jake Mintz, it is, that's it. We're done with 2025. That was the last podcast of 2025. Thank you all for listening.
Damn.
We will not be back later this week. Jake is on vacation. I'm working on some special guests for next week's shows. We will certainly talk about Imai and Okamoto. But thank you all for emailing us. Thank you all for listening all year long. Another year of podcasting. Look at us. How about that?
Can we talk about the Sabres for 2 minutes?
Guys. We kind of crushed this, okay? Listen, it's not they're not winning because we randomly chose in, what was it, April, that we were like, we need a team to root for. For those of you who are like, why do you keep talking about the Sabres? We got an email during one of our mailbag segments being like, hey, how has your fandom evolved now that you like work in baseball? Like, is it weird you don't get to really root for teams the same way? And we're like, yeah, that's true. Jake and I have never rooted for a team together in any sport. And we were like, you know what?
The Washu Bears.
Okay, sure. But for the most part, professional sports, we haven't really had a team together. And so we were like, we got to pick a team. Hockey, we knew was the right sport as like an off-season sport for us. Basketball was not going to be an option. Jake really is not into NBA hoops. Don't super blame him. And so now we're like, hockey, it's got to be hockey. We have to pick a team together. And we surveyed the NHL landscape. And we landed on these Sabres of Buffalo amidst this playoff drought, the longest in the league, and having never won a Stanley Cup. And it's just been a freaking thrill ride. I mean, what a treat to jump in with this team. They've won 9 in a row. They fired their GM. The new guy, Jarmo, is a freaking beast.
Kekalainen.
I trust this guy with my life. I've never had more confidence and just like, I mean,
he kind of looks like Jack Zarenzik.
No, you got to distinguish more between bald GMs there. I think it's a little disrespectful.
Okay.
But
we're locked in. Like, we're watching
Jarmo.
Every game.
I love Zach Benson. He's like 21. Oh. They're the youngest team in the league. So we are loving it. I'm obviously rocking my Sabres hat. I got a bunch of Sabres merch for Christmas, which was awesome. So shouts out to my in-laws for that. And yeah, man, we're having a good time. So hopefully we get
to care.
Hopefully we get to, and it's nice to care and not even really know what's going on. I just know which team I want to score. Yeah.
You know, my wife was like, she was like, I don't think we have time in our lives for you to care about hockey. And you know what I said? I said, I don't care about hockey. I care about the Sabres.
You're right. It's great too. Cause when we're watching baseball, we're always inclined. It's like, I want to have multiple games on. I don't care what's going on with the Dallas Stars. You know, ESPN Plus is like, oh, do you want a multi-view? I'm like, no,
nope.
I don't. I want the full screen for my birds, man. I need to make sure whatever, you know, Lindy Ruff is cooking up. He's had some interesting fits on the bench there. But anyway.
Last thing on this. If anybody who's a Sabres fan could explain why the intermission host has knuckle tattoos,
let us know. I'll have to email us. Sean about this. All right. Thank you, everybody. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. Happy New Year's. Thank you all for listening. And we will see you in 2026. And thank you. Thank you to Brett Rader for producing this podcast. Brett is the best. Brett pinch hitting here. with New Year's approaching. We appreciate him so much. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Brett. Thank you to Jake. Thank you to the fine folks who listen to Baseball Broadcast. Goodbye.